forever. Dog.
Comic books, comic time. Writers and artists are on the line. They make a splash as a comic's read and take us on a trip behind the spread. Watch out for comic book commentary. Spinning or winning inside, fix how they got a hot idea. Narrative, character, visual tricks, and onomatopoeia. It's comic book commentary.
All right. Hi, I'm Chelsea Kane. I am the creator of Maneaters, and this is Mirror Image, in which a image creator, such as myself, is asked to sit down with somebody who is creative but not in comics. And Image originally pitched me doing this with Meryl Streep, and I said no. I said, I'm just not into that. I want somebody really special and interesting, somebody I can really talk to. And Meryl, she's got a reputation. She's really difficult. So I asked my friend Corin Tucker if she might come and sit with me in this small room. And she said yes. It was very exciting.
I will stand in for Meryl anytime. Meryl's busy. Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that, but you actually do a lot of the work that Meryl gets credit for. Am I right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mamma Mia. That's actually.
No, Sophie's Choice. You were so good in that.
Thank you.
12 years old. You're back walking away. It's just stand in, but there's a lot of physical action there. Emotion, gesture. Yeah. So we don't really know what we're going to talk about. I'm sure it'll be interesting. I did notice something about us. We're both females.
That's correct.
Yes. And I noticed I write thrillers. And as a thriller writer, when I first started writing thrillers, I was told over and over again by people in publishing that they were really excited about my books because I was a woman who could write like a man.
Wow.
I know. I don't even really know what that means. I have some theories, though. And, I just think it's interesting how, as, women who make stuff, sometimes that becomes so much a part of our story. Mm-hmm. Like, certainly with you, right? In your early career, like, she's a girl who can also do punk rock. Like, what? Like, those things become so wrapped up.
Yeah.
And I wonder, like, how you feel about that. Does it matter? Do you try to separate it?
I mean, of course it matters. Unfortunately, I think being a creative person in an industry music is still has been so historically male dominated,
Mm-hmm. That's not true of comics at all.
Right. Of course. I think it did matter that we were, an all-female band and that we presented ourselves as really confident and, that we weren't going to take any crap from people. Mm-hmm. Of course it mattered. It became super annoying at times to be like another question about being women in music.
So like the question I just asked?
Shoot. Well, but, I think it's tricky with any creative project, how much do you let gender define it? Mm-hmm. And how much do you want to get free of gender by the work itself eventually?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that's something that we've been playing with for a long time. And I feel like now with the change that we've experienced in society, that people are really pushing the boundaries of gender. Mm-hmm. In a way that I think is really exciting.
Yeah. No, I do too. But I still feel like I would love to just be a thriller writer. I would love to just be a comic book writer. And certainly it is also as a comic book writer. I am always like in the context of being a female comic book writer.
Right.
And it is also a way to kind of like tell a story. Right. People want to have like a context, a narrative.
Right.
And it's something to talk about. And it's also something that is interesting because it is a point of view that is underrepresented. But it would also just be great to like, I look forward to the when we don't have to sort everybody first thing.
Right.
By that.
Do you think, because I know that one thing we also have in common is that we are parents of young girls. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that generation is going to experience it differently than we did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think they're going to... I'm going to answer the question slightly differently than what you asked, because I don't know if... I think they'll still experience... like patriarchy's pretty entrenched. You know, that might take a couple generations.
Yeah.
But how their behavior and their kind of experience and elasticity in terms of gender and... you know, everything, I think, is remarkable. It's remarkable to me. And it has forced me to get a lot more elastic in a way that I really love. Just, you know, having my daughter, you know, she has many friends who are trans or who are just, you know, middle school. And the way that middle school kids, at least in Southeast Portland, experience the kind of like intense self-discovery period is to try out different stuff. And so like she has many friends who switch pronouns like week to week, right? And or, you know, want to use a gender neutral pronoun. And so I've gotten or changed their names constantly. And at first that was really hard to stay on top of because I really wanted to respect it, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, our brains like are really elastic and mm-hmm. it got so much easier to just like one, it made me so aware of how, and I think of myself as, you know, like a pretty progressive person. Mm-hmm. It made me so aware of how I use pronouns, like in ways that are totally unimportant. Like how often when Eliza and her friends were upstairs and I needed them to come downstairs, I would yell, girls.
Wow. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's like, well, like their girlness is nothing to do with the fact that I need them to come downstairs and put their dishes in the sink. You know, right. Like that has nothing to do with it.
Right.
I have found this phase of her existence like really illuminating. I'm really mm-hmm. grateful for it as a parent.
That's awesome. Yeah. And do you feel like that is part of the inspiration for Maneaters?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like our kids are just so much more woke than it,
for sure.
Anybody. And that there isn't maybe as much content that is as woke as they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to, like many people think of Maneaters or at least try to position it as more of an adult comic.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote this comic for 14-year-olds.
Yeah.
And I think adults certainly can read it. Anybody can read it. But to say it's not appropriate for 15-year-olds or 14-year-olds, I think really kind of indulges in the point that I'm trying to subvert to begin with, which is that, you know, menstruation is somehow an adult topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
But mostly I wanted to write a comic for Eliza and her friends that explored some of the stuff that they were thinking about and also that recognized their rage. Because I think, especially after the last election, like I just saw all of these kids who were so kind of just kind of had whiplash from that. Like it really kind of like, you know, like really made them kind of rethink their place in the world.
Yeah.
And I wanted to give them this kind of like resistance story and also just get people used to talking about like periods, which should not be a topic that we have any trouble with at all. And yet so many guys still, they can't even imagine like buying tampons, you know, like it's this like really mortifying experience for them.
Yeah.
And so I think lots of tampons.
Yeah.
Or whatever you prefer to use.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I think that I just love the way it gives embodiment to that whole experience of being othered
mm-hmm.
into, you know, this amazing panther creature. Like, how did you come up with that idea?
Cat people?
Yes. Okay. I was wondering about that.
Yeah. The 1981 remake. So yeah. I've seen the original as well, which is a fascinating movie.
Great. Yeah. I love them both.
Yeah. They really are great. And yeah, like that very much obviously is about like the panther transformation is about in cat people is about female sexuality,
right?
But told from a very male point of view, right? Mm-hmm. But I started thinking about that and the fact that we have like culturally this like long tradition of pop culture manifesting our cultural anxieties as monsters, right? We do that all the time in, mm-hmm. in movies and books and whatever's freaking us out. Like we come up with a monster to represent it, whether, you know, it's vampires or zombies or, you know, aliens. And it helps us kind of work through mm-hmm. our some of our anxiety. And I started thinking, like, what is our cultural anxiety right now, this particular moment in time? Like, what is the thing that nobody really talks about, but that scares people? And I think it's women.
Yes.
I do. I think we're the monster.
Yeah.
I think that the Me Too movement has created this kind of like free-floating anxiety that that many men of certain generations feel like a woman could show up at any time, right, with a story that could derail their career. And I think that there's a free-floating anxiety about women suddenly wanting more mm-hmm. In a way that feels
threatening.
Yeah, like threatening and real. Mm-hmm. And I guess like thinking about that, like that, you know, women are the beast made me think like that would be really interesting to look at. Like there's so many layers of metaphor, obviously, in Maneaters. Sometimes I lose track of them. but I also, I think that transition between girlhood and teenhood, I think adolescence for girls, right, is we're still culturally so uncomfortable with that mm-hmm. because I think we want to protect, you know, that like I think there's this sense that our girls like actually do mutate into women. And I think that men feel really uncomfortable with that because they're shown all of these images that are meant to be really sexualized of young models, right? And told what is attractive culturally, right? And that happens to kind of fit a lot of like 13-year-old girl bodies.
Right.
And, it, you know, I think there's such anxiety there about like, how do we interact with these girls? And at the same time, we're also telling them that they're going to become monsters, that they're going to start bleeding from their vaginas. Like,
right.
And if that's something that you shouldn't talk about in polite company. Yeah, I think there's just so much to explore there. Plus cats.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love the way all of that plays out in the story. It's just, it's really visual in a way that I think lends itself to like reimagining how, you know, how we could interact, how we could treat that transformation, yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. How is having a daughter, you know, or having a son, is there a difference? Like, how has that affected your art in terms of, has it, you know, like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Deeply, I think. Yeah.
Because you don't have as much time for it.
Exactly. Because yeah. They're always bothering me. No.
So you get angry and then you rage.
Yeah. No, I think that, you bring a sense of vulnerability to your work that's really important as a parent because it's not just about you anymore. You're thinking about the next generation because they live with you and mm-hmm. you watch the impact of the world through their eyes, you know, like you said, you brought up the election. It's that was one of the worst things I've had to watch was I watched that election night through my 8-year-old daughter's eyes. Mm-hmm. And that was so much worse, you know, than watching it through my eyes. It was like, oh, I'm so sorry mm-hmm. that you are going to have to hear all of this, you know, misogyny and racism and just everything that Trump brought into the White House.
Right. It's like, you know? Oh, adults are failing you.
Exactly. Exactly. On the other hand, I am, like you said, I think our children are so much more woke than anyone else, you know, and that they bring so much inspiration to me to try and do better and be more aware of my choices in the world, you know? So I think that as tough as it is to be a working parent, I do want to, you know, like go for it with my music to show my daughter. I mean, my son just turned 18, so I feel like, well, he lived
he's
it.
Cooked.
He's cooked. My daughter's 11, and I think, you know, I want her to see, like, I'm going to, like, try as hard as I can to make the best music I can make and give it to the world and share that experience, you mm-hmm. know? So I think it's difficult to parent and to be an artist. You know, it's not an easy thing to do because you miss all of that, like, internal time, you know, that you're supposed to be creating things in your brain, you know?
Yeah, no, like, I think about that a lot, actually. The sense that, like, you know, when you have a kid as a parent, and maybe this is, like, I'm not sure if this is even true, but it feels true to me that maybe even mothers, particularly just because of a biology, like 15% of my brain is always on Eliza.
Yeah.
Yeah. No matter where I am or where she is, 15% of it is always, like, even not actively, but it's always, like, thinking about her. Like, mm-hmm. is she okay? Does she need anything? Did I turn in that elective, you know, like, choice mm-hmm. to school? Like, right. all that stuff, right?
Right.
Is she signed up for soccer? And that's a huge percentage. And if we're in the same house and I work at home, even if she's, like, on a whole different floor, like, that number goes up, right? Now mm-hmm. it's, like, at 22%. Mm-hmm. And that really starts to carve away at the, like, for me, as a writer, there's so much just, like, much of my work is what other people might call daydreaming or spacing out.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's building a world. And, like, it yeah. takes a whole lot to hold a world in my head.
Yeah.
It'll take hours just to kind of, like, get the world set and get my place in it and then get, like, start to work. And then any interruption mm-hmm. Sets me back. Like,
yeah.
it costs me mm-hmm. an hour, right? In a way that I think my family still does not quite understand.
Right. Exactly. No. Right. It just looks like mom is screwing around on her computer right. again, you know?
Right. And then I feel selfish.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Or I feel selfish because, like, Eliza wants to watch Wynonna Earp, and I love Wynonna Earp, and I would like nothing more than to go sit on the sectional and watch Wynonna Earp with her.
Right.
And then so, like, I do, and then I feel like a good mom and a good Earper, and yet a bad writer.
Right.
Or I stay, and I feel like a good writer, except that I'm not productive, because now I'm feeling like a bad mother, so I can't write.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a total catch-22, I think. Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, giving yourself permission to sometimes be selfish and be like, do not open that door.
Right.
This song has to be finished today or whatever mm-hmm. it is, you know, like.
I say that all the time. This song has to be finished today. I'm going to start saying that.
This song has to be done today.
Yeah. They'll finally take me seriously as an artist. Right.
Yeah. And then I sometimes feel like I have days where I can just catch up, mm-hmm. where I can just be like, let's go out in the backyard and play with the dog and garden and, mm-hmm. you know, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. It's okay to have, like, a catch up day where you're just mom, you know?
Do your kids listen to your music, or is it too weird for them?
It's too weird.
Yeah.
My son has told me, like, oh, I know it's good, but I can't deal with it,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
He doesn't like seeing me in all those roles and those characters. He mm-hmm. wants to see me as mom. Mm-hmm. Because that's what he needs from me. Mm-hmm. And that totally makes sense, mm-hmm. you know? But sometimes I have to admit it's easier if they're not there at a show.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Because you're conscious of them and how they're like seeing you.
Yeah. Especially my son. Like, he doesn't want to see all this weird. You know, because our show, it has, it does touch on women's sexuality, you know, and there is some like weird rolling around that sometimes happens that he's just like,
right,
literally turns his, his back, you know. So I think, yeah, it's a, it can be a little complicated that, you know, women are supposed to have all these different roles in life. And sometimes people don't want to see that other role that you have, you know, they're really important. You have to fight for all of them, I think.
I think, you know, I think a lot about point of view, just in general. I probably think too much about point of view, but especially I think that the fact that, you know, most industries are male dominated, at least historically, and like these industries that put out pop culture that, you know, reflect and instruct who we are back at us. Having like, it's shocking to me how few female voices there are, like how few female directors there are. Like, you know how that's a story, right? If you get like one female director or one woman writing comics or like, you know, one woman who's like shredding guitar, like that becomes, you know, but it's still then all these layers of producers above that, right? And that really affects the voice and how that voice is presented. And I love that that is starting to crack a bit, but it's still shocking to me how far we have to go. And I don't know how we can kind of like create a world that brings kids up in true gender equity until we have like lots of voices, like lots of, you know, that's what representation is all about.
Right.
Just having people, like the people in the world, tell the stories.
Right.
It's incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And like, I grew up like, you know, like I grew up playing Princess Leia, right? Like, cause she was the girl.
Right.
And I loved Star Wars, and it was great because like all the boys, they always needed a Princess Leia. But it never occurred to me to like play Han Solo.
Right. Yeah.
Like I dressed up as Han Solo for Halloween this past year. And it was like, oh, it was like a revelation. Like I looked so good. I looked so good. And I felt so powerful. And I learned that because a kid at Eliza's in elementary school, Nina, dressed up as Han Solo. Like it didn't even occur to her that she couldn't be Han Solo.
Right.
Right. It didn't occur to her that like, you know, like going drag for Halloween, would it all be like, it didn't bump at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, which is a huge generational shift because like it's not like as a kid, I would have, it just didn't even occur to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, me neither. I would never have thought like, oh, I'll just be, you know.
Right. I'll be Luke Skywalker.
Luke Skywalker. No way. You got to, I mean, the time you spend thinking about those buns and how am I getting my hair like that? Right. You know, like it's so ridiculous. And yeah, I think the more that we can, you know, all of the push to get women in, you know, film industry, music industry, all of that, I think it's super important. Comic book industry.
Yeah. It really pays off.
Yeah.
Like it really affects story.
Yeah.
In a way that to me like really reinforces the importance of diverse voices.
Yeah. So we were talking about comic books a little bit and you said that you've always been into comic books. Is that something that you grew up?
Like, you know, I say that compared to like my husband.
And I know your husband. That's why I'm laughing like lovingly.
Right. Who obsessively collected like, Marvel Comics for like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, that is different. Like he is a collector.
Right.
I am a comic enthusiast.
Right.
So he bags and boards his comics and I pile mine up on the bedside table.
Right.
But I, you know, as a kid, I read, like, as a little kid, like, you know, like Richie Rich.
I loved Richie Rich. What a great fantasy. I was like, he doesn't have any problems with money.
What he's got these friends. Like?
Yeah. A helicopter.
Jet. Yeah. Like, oh. And then I got into, like, ElfQuest, and I had a cousin, Jason, who we had a family reunion, and he brought all of these X-Men and Alpha Flight, and I started reading them. We got in a big fight because I had dog ear.
Oh, no.
It was epic. Like, everybody at the reunion still talks about it. But then he respected the fact that I loved these comics so much, so he started sending me comics, because I, as a, like, a, you know, 12-year-old girl, there must have been a comic book store in my town.
Right.
But I sure as hell didn't know where I was.
Yeah.
Like, or how to get there, or, you know, like, no, nothing. So the comics I had before that, like all the Richie Rich and that kind of stuff, that was, you could get on the, you know, like, newsstand, right? I didn't have to go to a comic book store. So Jason became my, like, you know, my dealer. And he would just send me, when he was done with comics, all, you know, like, all of these kind of, like, epic, you know, great, like, you know, Teen Titans. I got really into, like, X-Men, definitely, like, the Dark Phoenix saga, that whole thing.
Right.
And then, you know, like, I went to high school, and, like, again, I still didn't really know where to get comics. Mm-hmm. And I would read the ones Jason sent, but they kind of were fewer and far between. And there was just kind of no culture of that around me.
Right.
And then I went to college, and I would read the comics that, you know, all the big, you know, Watchmen and Sandman, and, like, the comics that kind of, like, permeated past, mm-hmm. you know, outside of the comic book store. And then in the early 90s, I got really into Fantagraphics and all the kind of, like, alt comics,
mm-hmm.
and read a bunch of those. And then I met Mark. And now, like, yeah, I went into Excalibur,
our local.
Yeah. And I was in my 20s store. And, went in there with Mark, and, I got, the first issue of Alias, by Brian Michael Bendis, which, right, has nothing to do with the TV show, but it's Jessica Jones. And I, you know, I just found it on the shelf. It had just come out, and I read it and was like, oh my God, like, I had no idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it could do that. And one of the things I loved about that comic is that it is drawn like people are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really, like, speaking of, like, representation and, like, point of view, the way that comics are drawn, like, superhero comics, it's often so, like, women don't stand like that. They don't.
On their tippy toes?
No one stands like that.
Yeah.
Like, what references are you using?
Yeah.
Like, because that's not, it's so, and, you know, like, it makes me crazy. And I loved, like, opening up Alias and seeing, like, Jessica Jones just, like, standing like a person, because it was all used, you know, like, they used, like, photo references, mm-hmm. Of, like, of an actual person to draw that comic. And it was so, like, empowering and thrilling in this kind of, like, visceral sense for me. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, what? You can do this. And she was funny and flawed, and also, like, you know, the smartest one in the room and relentless. And I loved it. So I started buying those. And then all of the kind of, like, ultimate stuff that Bendis was doing at that time, and then kind of widened from there. But I tend to, like, go on binges where, like, anything in my life, like, if I like it, I want all of it.
Right. Right.
I will not be stopped.
Yes.
Until I consume all of it.
Right.
So I fall in love with a particular series,
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, like, ignore everything else and read that, as opposed to, like, Mark, who is much more, has much more of a collector's mentality, where he wants to have, like, a completist,
mm-hmm.
kind of.
Right.
Yeah. Like, every title within, you know, like, a certain universe or whatever.
So when did you get the idea of, like, I think I'm going to write one of those comic books?
It was, you know, maybe three or four years ago. And I, Mark and I were like, we are close friends with Kelly Sue DeConnick and Matt Fraction, who are both comic book writers and like extraordinary ones. And through them, we kind of fell in with this whole kind of group of comic book people in Portland. And I loved talking to them about comics, which was good because comic book people, it's all they talk about. It's all they talk about. And I was particularly interested in Matt's run on Hawkeye because I found it, you know, as a storyteller, I really wanted to like puzzle it out. I wanted to reverse engineer it. I wanted to figure out why it was so good, like what he was doing there. And we started talking, like just having these like narrative discussions about the kind of architecture that he was employing. And I sat down with one issue. I remember that I finished it and was like, that is so good. Like, why is that so good? It's like 20 pages. Like, how did he do that? Why am I feeling these things? Mm-hmm. Why have I not ever felt this before? Like, I've read lots of comics. What is he doing? Mm-hmm. So I spent an hour, like, really studying it. Just trying to just the way that like I have lots of friends who make different kinds of art, and I love just that discussion of like, mm-hmm. how do you make your thing, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe that will help me make my thing better.
Yeah.
And you know, so like I'd been thinking a lot about it, and then people kept asking me, because I was always hanging out with these comic book people, like, when am I going to write a comic? And I go to cons, like, as a civilian, you know? Like, I just like this stuff. As a civilian. Yeah. And so they started asking. So I've got Bendis's How to Write a Comic book. That's not the actual name, but that's the subtext. I think it's called Books and Pictures, something like that. And I got it and like took it up to my office and secretly started to like attempt to write a comic to see if I could do it, mm-hmm. to kind of like break it. Right. And I couldn't. It turned out it was really hard and I didn't understand. But I also kind of like, I think just kind of started to feel a little self-competitive. Like I thought like I can't do it. So I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about, like, what kind of character would I want to write? And being steeped in the Marvel Universe, I thought it would be really interesting to write a female Marvel character and actually, like, again, point of view, get inside her head. Because, like, traditionally, all of the female characters in Marvel are told to serve other people's stories, right? Which means that, like, just batshit crazy stuff happens to them for no reason at all, except to make some guy feel bad.
Yeah, exactly.
So he can learn something about his wings or whatever. So I thought, like, wouldn't it be great to, like, know what the real story was, what they were really thinking? And I also find, as long as I'm on a rant, I find the notion of canon, I think it's really sexist.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that like that things that happen in the Marvel universe, and I'm just using that as an example, the fact that like what we see happening is considered what happened, and all of the stories being told are told by men.
Right.
It's problematic. And I wanted to kind of chip away at that, like where you have a female character who's like, no, actually, that's not what happened at all.
Right.
In, you know, 1982 and that like arc that you read, because nobody would do that.
Right.
Like, Mark actually was the one who suggested Mockingbird as being kind of a perfect female character because she was somebody who had never really had her own title. She was known, if she's known at all, as Hawkeye's ex-wife. But she'd had interesting things happen to her. And in the hands of good writers, you could see, like, she was interesting and she was smart. But she'd never told a story, you know, that was at all kind of like her story. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to write Mockingbird for Marvel. Like, that's settled. I should let them know. And so I emailed Bendis with my good news, because I thought, he could pass it along.
Yeah.
And he wrote back and he said, I'm going to come to your house and talk to you. And he did, like, within a couple hours. He was on my couch. He was like, I think maybe you don't understand how this works. Like, you don't just call up Marvel and say, like, yeah, like, this is the character I choose.
Yeah.
And that, you know, maybe I should do, like, a creator-owned comic first, or, like, and did I even really want to do this? He was very confused. But I was like, I listened to all of his concerns, and then I was like, well, thanks for coming over. Like, let me know when you've talked to Marvel about this exciting project. And then after, like, a couple of days, I emailed him and said, like, have you heard back from Marvel? And he, like, I wore him down, like, after a few more days. He was like, well, I got in touch with Marvel, and, you know, like... And they happened to have CB, actually, who's now their editor, was in town or coming to town. And he had dinner with Brian, and I was invited along. And we talked a little bit about Mockingbird. And then, like, 2 days later, I got an email from Axel, who's the editor at the time of Marvel. And, like, it was, like, literally, like, an editor from him – or an email from him saying, like, we've got a great idea. You should write Mockingbird.
Wow.
It's like, that is a fine idea, sir. But I knew nothing. Wow. I knew nothing. Like, what they wanted was a one shot. They kept saying that word. We want you to do a one shot for this anniversary. And I was like, so how many issues is that? And they were like, it's one. It's right there in the name, one shot. It's like, all right, okay. But I had to learn, because then I had that script to do, and I spent an inordinate amount of time on it, you know, but, like, it was super fun, and it was this kind of, like, random single issue, and it did well. People liked it, and they had not expected that, because nobody, like, you know, it's Mockingbird. They were really surprised, I think. And also, like, I'm a novelist, and novelists traditionally are really, really bad at writing comics. Like, I think twice before I buy comics written by novelists.
Right.
So I think it was better than they thought it was going to be. And then they asked me if I wanted to write an ongoing Mockingbird series, which seemed, you know, like, it could be really fun, and was fun for a while, and then wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in many ways, like, Maneaters, which is the same creative team, by the way, as Mockingbird, mm-hmm. Is my kind of, you know, response to that whole experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's cool.
And cats.
And cats.
And corgis.
Yeah. Yes. My daughter was really into that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's awesome. I love that story. You're like, so I'll be writing the Mockingbird story.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You guys are going to love this.
Yeah.
Sit down, because you might faint dead away.
Yeah.
Super neat. Good news. Marvel. I would still, like, one of the things that was so fun about writing Mockingbird is that, like, it comes with this full universe, right? Like, there's not only no world building, but there's this wonderful shorthand where, like, there's so many jokes, because people who read it, you know, you can expect that they have some knowledge of the universe. Mm-hmm. So, like, having, you know, seeing Tony Stark sitting in a waiting room reading a brochure on gonorrhea, like, it's funny. Like, people, like, that's all right. You have to do, right?
Right.
You just go right to the punchline.
Right.
And I really like that,
because
it was a different way of play for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's fun to make stuff.
Yeah.
It's fun to make stuff with friends.
Yeah.
Because most of the stuff, you get to do that. Like, I mostly just sit in a room for a year.
Yeah.
and then, yeah, like, tour with a book. And one of the cool things about comics is that, you know, everybody is contributing. And, like, you know, I think being in a band, there's that sense of, like, you're elevating one another and feeling like you're making something together that you can't make alone, or that is different.
Right. How do you do feedback between the writing and the illustration?
It's a weird comic because we do a lot of different kinds of art. So we have like the main interior artist. Like I give her a script, a comic book script, and the script. And I think a lot of people who don't look at comic book scripts don't know this, but because I certainly didn't when I agreed to start writing them. Most of the script is actually art direction. So the actual like dialogue, the words that you see on a page in a comic book, like that's a tiny percentage of what's written. So I go through every like panel, like page one, panel one, this is what we're seeing, right? And then this is, you know, these are the words on the page. These are the sound effects, all of that. And then Kate takes it and then she does sketches that are kind of really loose, mm-hmm. but mostly to kind of get a sense of where things are going to be on the page, where people are going to be in frames. And then I give feedback along with Leah Mitronique, who's my co-creator and kind of like art director. We give feedback on that. And then she does pencils, which are much more refined. And then we give feedback on those. And then she does inks. And at that point, you know, it's pretty solid. Like at that point, you don't want to be catching errors, although mm-hmm. sometimes they slip through, in which case they're patched. But then it goes to the colorist. And then the colorist does the colors, which is, to me, always one of the funnest parts because it really, it just comes to life so much. Mm-hmm. Like so much can be done with color. And we have such a great colorist, Rochelle Rosenberg. So then that comes and I will send her coloring notes before we even get started. I'll send her a script that like a colorist script where I can call out if there's any kind of color stuff, that I need to happen. And then the letterer and the letterer, like I used to think that the letterer just like wrote letters. not like dear Corin,
right?
You look great. Not those kind of letters, but like would just like literally letter it. But the most important thing the letterer does is actually like place the balloons mm-hmm. on the page, mm-hmm. Which can make or break like the pace of the story in a huge way. And I always find that really interesting to kind of see the choices that he makes, which you know like are so good. And so he gets then a lettering script. Again, which is a script, but calling out like any kind of environmental text, like if there's like if I want a sign on a door, that kind of thing, or if I have any ideas about wanting something particularly shouty or, you know, like a colored box. Hmm. And then I also at the same time am working with Leah on all the kind of like extra art. So we have I wanted to have like an element of like realism to kind of like remind us that even though this is this kind of like alternative world and clearly drawn, it's relating to the actual world that we live in.
Right.
So we try to use like stock art to reinforce that mm-hmm. or like.
The way that works.
Thank
in
you.
Yeah.
The puberty observation form, like mm-hmm. Scantron sheet, like a lot of extra bits like that. And sometimes they're actually like in on a page that Kate has done. Well, it'll be like a panel, which is usually an aside, like a cutaway joke to something inside Maud's head. And, you know, that might be like, you know, a map or like a picture of Time magazine with a, you know, with a girl turning into a cat on it. And then we do all of these ads for various like Estro products. So in Maneaters, the government has put all of these hormones in the public water to shut down girls' periods so they don't turn into panthers. And because of that, they don't certainly want the boys drinking that water. And so there's a lot of like Estro added or Estro free products. And those are really fun to like, cause it's endless to think about, just the satire of, you know, like not only advertising, but, the kind of like weird, like sexist, like mm-hmm. underpinnings of so much advertising.
Right. I love how you do that because there is so much positivity given towards boys who are mm-hmm. entering puberty. Like, you're going to be stronger. You're going to be bigger. Mm-hmm. And they literally just puff up you know, and that is, everyone's just like, great, you know? Yeah. And with girls, it's like there's so many more like flashing warning signs when that starts to happen.
Right.
You know?
Right. And not only about like feeling like their bodies, but about like you got to be prepared as a girl for like people are going to start to treat you differently. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like Eliza's, you know, gets catcalled walking up Hawthorne.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like it's crazy.
Yeah.
And Eliza goes to, a, you know, like a really good progressive school and they were doing like their unit on puberty. And they showed these slides about like what, you know, like what boys can expect in puberty and what girls can expect and side by side. And Eliza said, like, one of the things for boys was, muscles, you'll grow muscles. And Eliza raised her hand and was like, so like, girls can grow muscles too. Like, why is that only on the boys' side? That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the teacher hadn't even really thought about it. It was like, right. Oh, you're right. Like, let's all talk about that.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of stuff that is so sort of internalized that we don't call out. But, you know, anybody can like make muscles, you know, like anybody can get stronger.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But I worry about the messaging of like vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
That, that boys, you'll get stronger and girls, you're going to be more vulnerable and you're going to have to keep an eye out. And like, mm-hmm. boys might want to take advantage of you. And now suddenly you're going to be careful because sometimes grown men are going to holler at you from cars. And, you know, you need to start being safe. It's much more on them.
Right. Yeah.
Than it is like, they don't say to the boys, like, don't yell at girls from cars.
I mean, I think as parents, we do need to say that. And I mean, fortunately, my son has never done that. But but I think there is a lot of like, I think what's really beneficial about the Me Too movement and all that it's coming out is that young men are seeing there are actual consequences.
Yeah.
For, you know, for sexually assaulting someone, to harassment, to the whole rainbow mm-hmm. of things. It's like, oh, that guy lost his job. Mm-hmm. He got fired. Mm-hmm. And for a young man to see that, it's like, I think it's monumental, you know, to understand like there are, you know, consequences.
Yeah. And that
for crossing the line.
It won't be tolerated.
Like, no.
Yeah. We're done tolerating it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that attracted me to the story of Maneaters was to the idea of transforming into predators instead of prey.
Yes.
And thinking about like, you know, maybe periods like aren't a curse, right?
Right.
Maybe they're a superpower. Like it's a whole different way of thinking about girlhood.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that whole idea is, you know, it is a superpower.
It's crazy. We get to like, we can grow people in our bodies. What? Anyway, yeah. I think we're done. I think that was great, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Awesome.
Thanks, Corin.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Bye. Good luck in your next movie.
Thank you.
I know you're going to get another Oscar.
Forever. Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. Engineered and mastered by Alex Sarche. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.